This week's show is sponsored by Environments for Humans, who do all kinds of cool web conferences. Check out one coming up that both me and Dave will be at, the CSSSummit.com, and also Harvest at GetHarvest.com, time tracking and billing for anybody in client services. Check out those things. We'll talk about them a little bit more on the episode, but let's get this thing started.
Hello and welcome to episode 24 of the Shop Talk Show, a live podcast about web design, development, and all the fun stuff, hanging out in the frontish endish. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, everybody.
And Chris, do you want to introduce our wonderful guest today?
I would love to. We have today, as I tweeted earlier, the one, the only, the great David DeSandro. Thanks for joining us, David.
Whoa. Hey, yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And David is the man indirectly behind Pinterest's success.
That's right. Single-handedly, I can't really say.
Single-handedly developed Pinterest front end.
No. Dave says that because Dave is the guy behind Masonry, which was like the super mega popular layout plugin that kind of took boxes of different heights and laid them out on, because it's a difficult thing to do with floats. So this plugin would like kind of calculate their heights and do fancy stuff and lay things out a little bit like a brick wall. Is that a fair way to describe that?
Yeah. It's kind of hard to explain in words unless you just see it. And then if you know what Pinterest is, then you've seen it. And a lot of people have seen Pinterest. But I should address that. People at Pinterest, they actually developed their own solution, so probably none of my code is working behind there. And in fact, I think when you see it now on a bunch of different sites, they, like teams by themselves, develop their own masonry similar things. So it's great that I still get the credit, you know. And I didn't perform any of the work, but since this is a public broadcast, I might as well unless anybody's like writing checks right now. So
I remember there's a way to kind of not do the same thing as Masonry, because Masonry could do some super rad stuff like move them around and stuff. Or was that Isotope that did that, where they would like slide into their new position?
Masonry, you
could do that.
Can move stuff around, and then Isotope like was born out of that, because moving stuff around in Masonry, it was like such a dirty hack. And I was like, this is how you should do it. And then like 6 months went later and like people were having lots of problems with like, you know, this is like really ugly code and stuff. And I was like, yeah, I shouldn't have posted that. So, they both moved stuff around.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. There's a little confusion of what did what. But, you know, then I saw it, I don't know, even later than that, eventually it's a little bit possible to make something that looks masonry-like by using multiple columns in CSS3, literally if you set text in multiple columns, but use blocks like inline block, because if inline block is, you know, it looks like a floated div, but really, and then they kind of lay out in that same kind of brick wall pattern kind of thing, but it doesn't do as much cool calculation and stuff as Masonry does. But there's a kind of futuristic CSS3 way to get a layout similar looking to Masonry these days.
CSS is the only solution, and hopefully, I mean, this plugin becomes, or plugins like this become so ubiquitous that it just becomes part of the CSS spec. There really should just be a float Masonry or something like that.
Yeah, right.
I mean, if enough people use it, yeah.
Yeah. But that's old-timey stuff. You've done plenty of cool stuff since then. You're kind of also the 3D Transforms guy. You have a guide, the 3D Transforms Ultimate Guide, that's kind of like this amazing multi-page walkthrough of everything you'd ever want to know about 3D Transforms. That's a little bit more recent, right? You've gotten into that stuff?
Yeah, I think I wrote that for, what was it, 24 Ways? And it was the 2010 edition. So right before 2011.
Really? Yeah. I'm a little old. A little behind the times.
And yeah, at the time it was stuff because it was only Safari supported 3D Transforms.
Yeah.
And so I thought it was just such great technology that, you know, it makes people ooh and ah, like even if you just like flip a card around. So totally. It's like we should all be flipping cards constantly.
So everything I've been taught, what's new then? I feel like I've seen you recently. We were in Poland together at something that was fun, I remember.
yeah, we did Front Trends.
Yeah, that's right. That was the Poland one. And then we were in Vegas like the next week or something.
I know. It was the International Courier DeSandro World Domination.
It was fun, but you did some talks there like Mobile Safari, Bring Your Machete. We talked about some difficulties.
This year I haven't like I think the one thing I will produce is like how I've been showing my slides, like my slideshow. I've not been coding as much, but I have done a couple talks, one was about Mobile Safari and just I've had a lot of experience with that, and the other one's about like making fun animations and getting like try to be emotional about it.
Cool. I don't think I saw that one. I gotta get out.
David, were you behind the Beer Camp 2012 site? Was that?
I was behind the guy who did it.
Okay, there you go.
So, no. Beer Camp 2012. That was done by my colleague Tom Genitasio, whom I hate because he's like so incredibly talented that it's just like it makes you feel inferior, right? Because I have my thing. I've got my 3D Transforms, and like I wrote the intro to it, and then like he shows up, and now he's like doing like the flip book thing, and then did you see the last thing he did called Photon, where he built this lighting system for 3D vectors.
I didn't associate that it was the same guy, but
it is the same guy, right? Like, I'm pretty sure he has, like, a team working for him at this point because one man cannot contain all that talent. But I did do the Beer Camp 2011, which was,
Tom, right?
Tom did Beer Camp 2012, and that was the flipbook. I did the 2011 one.
The Zoomer.
Which was the Zoomer, yeah.
Okay.
That was cool, too.
There's just so much amazingness, it's hard to keep track.
Well, cool.
Okay, well, that's a good intro to David. He's a smart guy, and he apparently knows a bunch of many smart people as well. Most recently now working at Twitter, so congratulations on that.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure. And now he will help us talk about more front-end stuff as we move forward here. Do you have something, Dave?
Yeah, before we – well, I don't have any hilarious questions to open with today, but I did for longtime listeners of the show. I wanted to update you on the current status of the soundboard. We now have two brand new sounds in the soundboard. Well, three. I'll do three. So the first one is the Wheel O Hot Drama.
No whammies. Is it that one?
Yeah, I think it was the Price is Right wheel there. So so we might need to use the Wheel O Hot Drama occasionally. The next one is hot off the press from last week. It is
dang,
which no doubt that's Tim Smith, and he will forever be on this podcast, I believe. And then the next one is probably my favorite. It comes from the Jeffrey Way episode, which was, I believe, episode 5, like way back. But this little soundbite is probably my favorite. Here we go.
Ooh, laptop. Ooh, laptop.
That one is my favorite.
Ooh, I could do that one live.
Ooh, laptop. All right. Well, we'll just be on the lookout for those as we move on in the show. So. Chris, you got news and links for us here?
A little bit. I wanted to Paul Irish did a little post called the skinny on how IE is going to be updating, right? And he kind of explained their policy on that. I don't think it was like breaking news, but Paul kind of broke it down, how it's going to work. Oh God, now I'm all unprepared.
Give me the lazy web version.
Yeah, totally. It's basically that you know, Windows has that auto update thing that runs. What is it, like the first Tuesday of every month or something like that? They're going to start like kind of forcing, but secretly marking Internet Explorer in those updates as like you automatically get it unless you jump through some hoops in order to tell it not to do that. Which means that there's like this whole swaths of people that are going to get booted up to. People on XP will be on IE8. People on Vista and 7 will be get up to IE9. And then he's saying here that IE10 is only going to work on Windows 7 Plus, which I thought wasn't true. But maybe, yeah. I mean, he wrote it. And he's usually right. So anybody on Windows 7 will then get IE10. So anyway, it's just going to be this massive upgrading of people from older IEs to newer IEs. And then just, you know, maybe we should, can you spin the wheel of hot drama?
Oh yeah, here, we'll spin the old wheel here. Go on.
Tio Lopez writes in about this thing. This was other news that came up in the world of web dev recently, is jQuery announced that in 2.0, which they're at 1.7.2 right now. We talked about 1.8 last week and some new stuff coming up. Then there'll be 1.9, and then there'll be 2.0, which isn't going to be until 2013. So this is like way advanced news, news in the from the far future. They're going to drop even IE8 support. jQuery 2.0 will be IE9 plus only. When people are like, that's crazy, you know, like it wasn't so long ago we were talking about IE6, like, but you know, supporting IE8 is pretty much a must. I thought we were all on board of supporting IE8. Anyway, hot drama, jQuery 2.0 is going to drop even IE8.
That seems really early to me, but if you think about like,
it goes hand in hand with this auto update stuff.
Yeah, I guess given that all XP machines will be IE8, and then XP is like a 10 or 20 year old piece of software, you probably should drop it. Ah, that's interesting.
But well, here's the deal also, yeah. Right? And this is thanks Lewis Lazarus again, who I listen to the show once in a while. I know he wrote about it too and says it's not even that big of a deal. Basically, jQuery 1.9 is going to still support those older things, and you can just use conditional comments and load 2.0 for the new stuff. And, headphones came off, and 1.9 for the old stuff, and it should pretty much just work. It's just 2.0 will be like lighter weight and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, people have been clamoring for this kind of, you know, like a lot of, or we feel that a lot of jQuery is inhibited by older browser support. So it's like, yeah, let's make it more awesome, you know?
I agree. And maybe I'll shut some people up that kind of think of it as this bloaty library because it has to deal with that old stuff, which, as I understand, isn't entirely true. But if jQuery 2.0 is 15% smaller, that's cool.
Yeah. I think a lot of jQuery could probably, you know, head out, you know, the animate library and stuff like that, because you can really do a lot with CSS now. And it seems more programmatic to do so.
This week, if you want to download a copy of it that doesn't have animation in it, that will be possible.
I should do it.
That's all I have to say. Let's do some Q&A. We have a couple that are just for David, although we'll get to those soon enough. Let's start with this one by David Martin, who's asking all of us in this podcast right now, in the world of separation and cleanliness, HTML equals content, CSS equals styling, JavaScript equals action, change, functionality type stuff. If I sound weird, I have a weird growth in my mouth. It's freaking me out.
It's a tooth.
So David asked, why is CSS 3 moving in the direction of transformation and animation? Especially if I want to animate something and then do something else at the end of that animation, which is hard to do in CSS. He just wants to know what, I don't know. Well, talk about, I mean, you've been embedded in this world for a long time, David. How do you feel about this, like, people that think CSS3 is, like, edging in on JavaScript's territory as for animating and stuff? Do they belong in CSS, or should we leave it in JavaScript? What's up?
Well, from what I understand, it does muddy up the delineation between, you know, the action stuff that happens that's actionable and stuff that happens that's just present or, you know, stylistic, right? Mm-hmm. But CSS and they're all kind of like, you know, the same ingredients in the same bowl of soup. So yeah, it might be frustrating when you're writing out, like, you know, five animation keyframes in CSS. But the benefit is, you know, that stuff kind of hooks in at a lower level into the browser. So hopefully clients and users, they get a better performance, right? And at the end of the day, it's all about, you know, the person at the other side of the screen and what they're looking at. They don't really care if it's done with CSS or JavaScript. As long as it, you know, you click something and it opens up and it's a nice animation. Mm-hmm. People are delighted by that. So, you know, like, you know, hey, this it's only going to get muddier, you know?
Maybe. I don't know. I feel like when JavaScript animates something, what it does is it, like, really rapidly changes the inline styles of something. And yeah. I find it weird that anybody could be like, that's the way to go. That's the best way to do animation. I'm like, that feels so gross to me. It was cool that yeah. we could do it, but...
For me, I feel like David Martin's separation, it's true. That's how things used to be. It was very important that we kind of set these boundaries for these separate technologies. We were like, HTML is your content, CSS is your styling, and JavaScript is your behavior. But that's kind of the old way, and that gave everyone boundaries to operate in. But now... Well, like CSS can be more powerful and it should be more powerful. It, you know, if you change the color of a link, like on hover, then what's the difference between transitioning and animating that or tweening, as we old Flash guys might say? You know, so now you're just creating, like, you know, separate states that you're transitioning through. And then your JavaScript is still your behavior that, like, fires the states, you know, whether it's, like, I don't know, body loaded and then you fade something in or something like that. I
don't think it's a trend. It's not getting worse. Like, nobody's talking about being able to make Ajax calls through CSS. You know, like, I can see how this conversation is a little gray, but I don't think it's getting much worse beyond this. Maybe I'm wrong. David also asked, I want to do something when the animation is done. There are JavaScript hooks for that, I believe. Isn't it like animation end, basically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then there's a problem where, let's say, you writing kind of sort of a library and you're like, animate to full opacity and it's already at full opacity and you want to get that transition end event will not actually trigger. Yes, there's a way to do it, but it's not like, That's one of the good things about JavaScript animation libraries is that, like, you know, they make it their job. So when you say .animate and then .css, you know, after that, or callbacks, you know, it will work. But this is still experimental.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it just because the specs aren't ready to go on that type of stuff? People were early to implement it? I don't know. Or maybe it's ambiguous.
Yeah. I think these problems are still surfacing. You know, where, like, you want to transition something from zero to visible, and it's already on display none, so you have to show it. You know, there's problems with that.
Lots
of problems. It's a mess.
Right, because you may, in some circumstances, you may want it to go either way. You may not want to fire it because whatever it does after firing it is something that doesn't need to be done, or you might want it to fire for sure. That's hard.
Yeah, I would say if you still need, like, strict chaining of your animations, like this guy triggers this guy, like dominoes falling, then I would use JavaScript, you know, jQuery, chain it. Get on the chain.
Here's an interesting one. Speaking of specs and stuff, from Galen Gidman, who does the Young Guns podcast and also is on Tim Smith's East Wing podcast, right?
Yep. I think so. Yeah. Oh, did you say Tim Smith?
Dang.
All right. Here we go.
Hey, Chris and Dave. I was wondering if you could explain why there is no way to inset a text shadow in CSS like you can do with box shadows, and if that will ever be something that may become available, because it would be so useful with things like icon fonts. That's a big one right there, or even just really big text where you wanted to kind of give it like an inset look. So why can you not inset a text shadow?
Dun, dun.
And the answer is, I have no idea. Do we know why?
I think maybe text shadow was built on the understanding that all fonts were 1 pixel wide, possibly.
So, yes. To have something inset, it would just there would be nothing there.
But that's not true with Chunk 5 or Lobster.
Those are some excellent examples.
Yeah, that's the HTML5 fonts.
Yeah. Oh, your site's in HTML5. Use Lobster. Lobster.
I think we could safely say that the reason that they didn't start. I mean, the use cases are minuscule compared to outset text shadows. So if they were choosing to implement one or the other, it's no doubt they chose what they did.
Yeah, well, and it could also totally mess with anti-aliasing. But then again, it's just like Photoshop, right? Like inside stroke or whatever Photoshop calls it.
Have you ever desired this, David?
Yeah, a couple times, because this will be something that you get on a Photoshop comp, and then you're not able to do it. And I think it voices a real problem, is that, we want features in CSS, and we don't know the proper way to go about asking it. Like, have you guys ever been like, I want this, I'm thinking about this to be part of a spec, like, this should be in. And it's like, where do you even begin? Like, you have to sign up for a mailing list, or like, you see some post, and it's from some... like arcane kind of, like everything I see in the CSS, like the discussion things, it's like this weird mailing list system. It's like, haven't we evolved beyond this? We're still looking at mailing lists for the CSS spec. It's like, it grosses me out every time. And it's like, I don't know if that's where I begin or if that's...
That is where you begin. The best there is. As I understand it, that's where you begin, is those weird mailing lists. You also probably, you have to put together... Not examples of like, hey, wouldn't this be cool, but here's a legitimate problem I have, and a couple of them and a couple different use cases, and show them off. And then you have to get some developer sentiment around it, that it's not just you, a crazy guy, it's other people talking about it. Then you can start one of those group things, but we all know well how those work with all the work that they put into responsive images that kind of, it didn't go nowhere, but it didn't end up kind of... Anyway, I agree. Everybody works in the specs. If, for example, I find very nice and very legitimate, reasonable people, and I think their process has kind of worked. It's getting better, but they're always like, "We want feedback, feedback, feedback," and you're like, "What? Where is the WooFoo form that says feedback?" It's always like, "Sign up for this weird thing that doesn't quite look like a website." They send an email, and then that email somehow ends up on that website. And it's very strange.
I think the W3, after all that hot drama around images, I think all the W3C and the What Working Group and the CSS Working Group, they, like, really and truly, they have a design problem. Well, just huge. I mean, like David was saying, you're going through these, like, old, like, Yahoo style text emails, and like trying to click your way through a thread, and it's miserable and terrible, and the way people quote each other.
It's particularly sad because a guy like David DeSandro wants to give feedback, and it's preventing him from doing it. And we sit in front of computers all the time. Like, you got to lower that bar a little bit so you can get more of it and not turn off people whose feedback would be super valuable.
Thank you, Chris. I thought I was crazy. It's like you see one of those pages and you're like, oh, well, this timestamp will be from 1998. And you're like, wait, this was last week? They're talking about this? You know? It's
weird when you see one of those pages.
Yeah.
And you have like no idea what they just talked about. It's a full-time job to like be on top of it, you know? I signed up for the CSS working group one because I thought, yeah, I do CSS. I like it. I want to learn the ropes. Freaking like 800 messages in an hour on like font rendering in Chinese or something like that. And I was just like, man, not what I want.
We got off on a tangent here. Galen's question was about inset text chat. Idea. Well, unless you do, I don't have any idea why you can't do that now, other than they just, you know, haven't gotten to it yet or haven't spec'd it out or something.
I think it's worth fighting for. Raising.
You can do it on box shadows, so let's just. It is one of those funny things. I'm sure it has a million reasons why it's harder than doing it on box shadows, but people will look at this problem and be like, hey, I can do it on box shadows. Why don't you just take that code and copy and paste it and let it work on, you know, fonts? That's the kind of short-sighted stuff we need to not suggest, because I'm sure it's more complicated than that. But yes, we all want it. We don't know why. Next question.
Okay, next question is from Sean E. He says, I'm a recent graduate entering the world of front-end web development, and I'm curious how you guys see the industry in terms of opportunities. I want to work for a bigger company, but it seems most designers, developers either do freelance work or work for smaller companies. Does this mean that you have to be just amazing or the best to get a job for a bigger company? Is the field oversaturated? Do most companies just use freelancers or outsource? Whoa. So what's the state of the...
To work at some big-ass company. Do you have to be the best of the best to work at a big company? What do you think, David?
Well, there's plenty of opportunity out there. So just get working. I think like if you're just starting out, the hardest thing is always just building a body of work. And maybe the bigger companies, you might think you might not have a chance there because you don't have a big portfolio. So maybe that's why you might have a better chance of some small places. But every company out there needs or has or wants to have a web team. So if you're like really big into something like Pop Rocks and you're, you know, happen to like web design, you could probably get a job or making Pop Rocks sites. You know, like there's plenty of opportunity there. Don't feel that you have to work for like some shop, like, you know, like Include or stuff like that. There's, you know, you'd be surprised where you talk to people on the web and they work for, there's Rosetta is based in Washington, D.C. So they have a huge like web team, like Rosetta Stone. So lots of companies like that around.
No shortage of jobs. I'll tell you that. In this, especially if you're, you know, half good. You have to be at least half good.
I like that. Yeah, half good, and you can probably get a job anywhere. Yeah, I'm sure. Like, if you like, just Google like Mountain Dew web, like you could probably be working for Mountain Dew by the end of the day. I mean, I'm just guessing, but they just do so much. You know, you gotta like. I mean, if you want to work at a big company, yeah, cut your teeth there.
Or I like this question because it said. It seems like people that, I don't know, like us three, for example.
Yeah.
And a lot of us, we don't work for big companies. He's saying, are these people that do like much, are they just incredible? And I find that to be the opposite of true. That's why I like this question. Not the opposite of true. But I'm sure there's some amazing developers at really large companies. But in general, for whatever reason, it attracts kind of, if you want to call them the best of the best, they just like the atmosphere at smaller companies better. They like the freedom of freelancing, whatever it is. And that big companies are probably a little easier to get a job at, I might say. And I don't know. You know what I'm trying to say?
I mean, yeah, there's benefits with being at big agencies. Like you get to work with big brands, but that you might not be able to make a brand for your personal self. So, yeah, look at PR agencies if you're into that, or, you know, otherwise start doing a freelance thing. Plenty of room.
Yeah.
Unless you're trying to make another masonry, then butt out of that. So,
but not. You know who we have this week sponsoring? Back again. after a brief hiatus of sponsoring Harvest. GetHarvest.com. And gosh, who are we talking about that uses it really good? Anyway, if you're in client services at all, it's all about tracking time and invoicing for that time. And they have like cool Mac apps and phone apps, and like it does awesome stuff. You're like, oh, I hate starting a timer every time I work on stuff. Or, what if I walk away from my computer and forget it? Well, it has all that intelligent stuff built in. If you walk away from computer, you're not touching it. It will stop the timer for you and do smart stuff like that. So you're tracking your time as accurately as possible. It's a web app, basically. It's a really nicely designed web app for tracking your time for your different clients so that you can bill them appropriately. What else do we have to say about Harvest? It's just a nice app.
It's nice and it works well. And yeah.
You can accept payments. If you your clients want to pay you with credit cards, they can do that way. Send invoices.
It's borderline fun. Which is weird to say for an invoicing application. or time tracking invoicing. It's fun. It's like entertaining.
That is a poster quote if I've ever heard one right there. That should be right on the top of the site.
Yeah, let's.
It's borderline fun.
I mean, it's. Oh, that was good. The way that soundbite is pretty good.
So use coupon code SHOPTALK. 50% off your first month if you go check out Harvest. And you don't have to be a web designer to use it, man. I don't know why you'd be listening to this show otherwise, but if you happen to be a carpenter, you could possibly use their iPhone app to track your time when you go to house.
Yeah. That's anyway. Good. 50% off, man.
Dang.
Okay. Let's move on. Next question is an audio question, our favorite kind of question here on the Shop Talk Show, from John Heller.
Hey, guys. So I don't usually like to admit this publicly, but I fear I may have a case of divitis, and I wanted your opinion on it. A good example I have is I'll declare header styles, of course, from my website that I use all the time, and then say someplace I have a disclaimer under post a comment, something like that. So in theory, that should be a header tag under this div of comments. The problem, though, is were I to use one of my H2, H3 tags, I'd have to go through and disable all the different styles I already have applied to that H2 tag in order to just create one or two additional ones. Whereas instead, I'll often just use a div tag, and then since I have a blank slate, just apply the styles that I want. But this seems like it goes against proper CSS coding approach, because now I have a div where in theory I could have an H2 or H3. It just seems like so much more effort. So I was wondering what you guys thought about that. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, tough one. I side with CSS Wizardry. Remember you gave a great talk and the Nicole Sullivan approach? Where you start thinking about things like abstracting them. So you're not so much relying on the tag itself, but probably a class. So you can get out of sticky situations like this.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, John, right at the end kind of jumped the shark, I feel like. Not your question, John, but I was like, if you're using a div instead of an H2, then you're like leaving semantics behind a little bit. I mean, if it's a header, use a header tag. But maybe you can use classes to make up from that. I wouldn't just make everything on the page a div. But if you need to use a div just to apply some styling, like a module of some kind, I would think that's okay. And then be a little careful with how many you nest, you know. I mean, remember that you can apply multiple classes to the same div. So I don't think there's any reason to, like, nest multiple divs to give them individual classes to apply styling. Unless I'm...
I think if you can apply a class to the H2 and say, like, you know, .mywidget.headline or something like that, and that's what you're styling on for your H2, that's the best case scenario. But if you're in, like, a content management system where, you know, the client isn't going to put that that class there, then maybe for that widget, like, .mywidget or whatever, you set up typographic rules, like you're like my widget H2, my widget H3, you know, in your CSS, and you kind of like create a sub module of all the typographic styles you'd want there. But yeah, if you're just renaming H2 to div, then I feel you've lost your semantic value.
And if you have, why isn't that H2 working for you a little bit? I feel like even pointing in the chat room saying, well, the class in the H2 might have to unset a bunch of things because, let's say, you want this H2 to look drastically different than H2 elsewhere. That seems a little funky to me. That, like, how complicated is this website that this that the default H2 styling is 100 miles away from the H2 you use elsewhere? And it touches on another, like a Christopher Epstein thing that I posted about a while back called opt-in typography, where maybe if you're really worried about – if you have this like root level H1, H2, H3 kind of thing going on, then you find yourself having to change that styling completely because you're in a module or because you're in the sidebar or something, maybe you should go for this concept called opt-in typography where – you kind of reset your typography and then only apply any typography to lists and headers and block quotes and all that stuff if you're in a module that wants it to use like a class of text or something. And then it's like, oh, I see this is a text heavy kind of area of the site, so that now I want all those styles.
That,
but if I'm, yeah,
no, I've thought about that recently, maybe just abandoning a global H1, H2, H3. Yeah, David, you have any thoughts on the subject? What do you do?
I'm pretty lucky in that the sites I get to build are pretty isolated, and I'd never really have to build big sites. So you guys probably said all the smart things.
Whoa.
Perfect. Well, cool. Next question, and we'll keep moving on. We're trucking here. Benjamin Solomon wrote in saying, I'm working on an HTML5 input polyfill for fun in my spare time.
Yeah.
I love it already. I'm trying to validate. Oh, wait. That deserves a sound effect. Working on a HTML input polyfill in my spare time.
Ooh, laptop.
And then that was the perfect use for it, right? I'm trying to validate an input type URL in JavaScript exactly as the Chrome browser does, but can't find any documentation on a JavaScript or Perl compatible regular expression. I've done some limited reverse engineering, but it's going to take a lot of time to get it right, and I'm not even sure if I can nail down all the special cases. So my question is, do you know of an identical pattern in Perl syntax? Gosh, there's gotta be one, right?
So what he's talking... Oh, go ahead.
What's the input type?
URL.
And so we're looking to get a regex that matches that.
Yeah, URL. So he's making this polyfill for inputs, and he wants to validate with right. a regular expression input type equals URL. So I think it's got to exist. Maybe, no, what about...
I just Googled it, and I found like 100 of them. So I wonder if Benjamin knows something that we don't, because it's like a one-liner. Although how well it does that is questionable.
Especially with all these new TDLs, like .apple or whatever. iPad.apple.
Just so if anybody has no idea what we're talking about, HTML5 input type URL will automatically validate a URL without you doing any of this fancy regex, writing your own polyfill, any of that stuff. If you mark it as a URL and you type, if you have an input type URL and you literally just type the word Apple in it and try to submit the form like that, it will be like, no, dude, that's not valid. And it will give you an error, and there'll even be this little cool pop-up that pops up that says that is an invalid input for this type of thing. That newer browsers do that. And he's saying older browsers don't. He wants to do a polyfill in the great tradition of polyfills, which is just include this JavaScript on your page. And God, I sound like a little girl with the stupid thing in my mouth. Include the JavaScript on the page, and it will just sense if this browser supports or doesn't support that ability and make it work in older browsers. So he needs to write his own validation for that input. First of all, number one, I'd look this, you know, Benjamin, as cool as this is and ooh laptop-y as this is, somebody's written this before. So first of all, look around on GitHub or whatever and try to stand on the shoulders of someone else's work. And then just Google validate URL JavaScript, and there'll be a bunch of things that come up.
There was a jQuery validate plugin, and it just does validation. It's not, you know... And you'd have to say like class URL required or something like that in your markup. But it worked pretty well for URL. I believe. So maybe nice. There.
Have you ever dabbled in the world of polyfills, Dave?
Yeah, I did a input range polyfill.
No way.
So, yeah, for the 3D transform thing, because there wasn't. I wanted to do it on the iPhone, and it wasn't supported on like iOS whatever for when I launched.
So you could have like a finger thing where you tap it and drag it to do something cool or something.
Yeah, and I would argue that it's way better. My polyfill is better than the native that they eventually, because when you have an input range on an iPhone, your finger is bigger than the button itself. So my input is like 40 pixels tall.
Nice. It's
like on that
literally
button visible.
Improve the UI. Yeah, cool, and it would do some cool testing to see if it was supported or not. Did you do it at a time where literally iOS didn't have any support for it? It does now, doesn't it? iOS has a type range.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't that expressive. But I would say doing like that kind of activity, building your own polyfill, was a great way to like build up your chops. Because then you start thinking about things like, oh, yeah, what if I, you know, what happens when I tab out of here, you know?
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And like, what if, I suppose, like, do the events work in the same way? Should I use the same ring for events as other things do? Or should I like prefix them so I don't conflict? It's complicated stuff. Benjamin, keep working on your polyfill input. If nothing else, to build your chops. But if you're absolutely stonewalled, look some stuff up.
And let us know what you come up with. Send a link.
Oh, as always, this week we have Environments for Humans sponsoring. They do tons of web conferences. One coming up is the CSS Summit. Check out CSSSummit.com. Both me and Dave are speaking at it, talking about CSS and all its glory. And I really want to get some of you guys to come out to the Hawaii one, InControlConference.com. It's a live in-person conference in Honolulu Highway. Honolulu, Hawaii. Coming up in December. Control. Hold on before I make a fool of myself. Yeah, I'm going to go learn to surf, maybe. Probably not. I'm going to be there. December 2nd through 4th in Honolulu. In Control Conference.
And that CSS conference is going to be legit. It's like a 3-day deal. It's one day is like devoted entirely to SaaS, I believe. So.
Oh my God, the whole day? That's
so
awesome.
I think
so.
It's pretty cool.
Do you write any SaaS, David? Or are you like old school?
I'm still old school, man.
It's cool. It's cool.
I'm just, like I said, like I don't write the big sites. I don't have the chops anymore, man. They don't even give me that responsibility. Just write my widgets.
That's interesting, though. But you know, we all know Twitter Bootstrap is on Less, right? I don't know. I don't want any awkward silence. What you can talk about, and not talk about. But you'd assume that Twitter would use Less.
I haven't dug into that. What we write the CSS for. On Twitter,
okay.
So I can't say.
Hmm. Oh yeah. So CSS Summit, July 31st through August 2nd. It is July now, so it's just coming up in like 3 weeks. So, check out the tickets for that. You don't need to buy plane tickets for this one, folks. It is an all online conference that you can just watch from your computer. Make some popcorn. Honestly, more like have one browser tab open of the conference and the other browser tab open to work and Google things and watch funny videos on YouTube. You can do it both at the same time, like the future, like in Back to the Future when he was watching TV and he was watching like 8 things at once. That's now.
It's now. The future is now.
I want to do this last one because it's – what do you got?
Oh, go. Yeah, do it.
I got a question for you guys actually.
Yeah. Let's turn this thing around.
Do you ever wonder why Internet Explorer doesn't get invited to the concerts?
Oh, I'm. Hold on. Yeah, why does Internet Explorer not get invited to the concerts?
Because you can't add event listeners.
Oh, wow, that was good. That was really good.
Oh my God. That was my best one. I wrote down a bunch of them, and
I gotta get off the floor.
Hold on a bit. I'm going to just go roll on the floor. Oh, man. That was good. That was
under our ridge.
I have to squeeze it in before the show ended.
No, we have a little bit of time. I wanted to ask this one from Dennis, who's sent Greg Gauss, who's in the chat room now, I think. And Oh, listener, he wanted to know, who is your Yoda? Do you have like a... I know you talked about some guys you worked with before. Do you have a particular person, David, you really look up to in your work?
Yeah. I mean, Paul Irish, definitely. I mean, I think it's... Everybody kind of mentions him. Mm-hmm. And then... you just call him out. And then Jonathan Harris, who's kind of like... you don't really hear much from him anymore, but he was real big back in the Flash days. And he kind of talks about bigger issues in terms of like making sites and the experiential things of the web. Number 27.
Yeah, I see that. He has a paragraph of text on his homepage that is an image. So he's a little old school.
Yeah, he's a busy guy. He's a busy guy.
No, I've never heard of him, actually, which is embarrassing. I'm your new fan, Jonathan Harris, by proxy. Yeah, that's cool. I just thought that's an interesting question. I like that you phrased it, who is your Yoda? I feel like
who's your Yoda, Chris?
Oh. Can I have Paul, too?
I don't know. There can only be one master and one Padawan.
Save that for later. Dude, that's like a thinker. Although it should be obvious. It's not like Luke Skywalker had to sit and think about who his Yoda was. He would just point. But it might be true to like reflect on your career a little bit and be like, who taught me all the cool stuff that I know, you know? I definitely give props to like Tim Chapman, who I worked for a couple years in Madison, who was like a small design studio, and he ran the studio, and I feel like he did a good job of that and kind of set me free and was pretty influential in my career. And I could go way back to middle school and stuff. I had some good programming teachers. It's kind of like that. Isn't there like, what's that? The guy that writes those like profound books or whatever, like if you do 1,000 hours, then you're good at it, or 10,000 minutes. Or who's that?
Gladwell?
Yeah. Gladwell. He did one about like, yeah, Malcolm Gladwell. He wrote one about how like nobody who's like really successful just got there randomly, and that like idea of the American dream and stuff is kind of crap. It's mostly just like you had all the right things happen to you at all the right time. And I looked at my life and I was like, totally. I had a computer super young and everybody was supportive of me. I had good teachers. I was able to get jobs at the right time and stuff. I'm like, I didn't come from a hard place and overcome every obstacle there was, and then it all turned out okay. It was all just product of circumstances and making the most of them. That's my Yoda, the universe.
Nice.
So, all right. Nice. it's like the people that on Twitter, if they tweet, you like look forward to their tweets because you're like, you know, they're going to be some worthwhile stuff.
Yeah. Speaking of which, Paul, you haven't tweeted in like 4 days. You okay?
I think Paul has... He has the problem where so many people follow him that like he'll crash at the site. So it's like, it's a huge responsibility when you think about it. Like, is it worth telling somebody this, or is it worth crashing their site?
Yep, getting palled, getting Irished. Well, let's do more questions. We have at least can do two more. Don't you think? Are we all still fresh?
Oh yeah, I'm still good to go here. This one's from Tom Watercheck, I believe, is how you pronounce that last set of of consonants. So he's asking, with all the web apps out there being built in browsers, do you now have to account for all of them, or are they all mostly based on WebKit? Just wondering.
It's like you open a link in Twitter, mobile phone. We're not. Okay. But it's just a web view, right? It's the same built-in browser that Safari uses on your phone. It's not like they build their own browser just for an app.
Yeah. And maybe I read that wrong. With all the built-in browsers, like apps with their own built-in browsers, that should all be mobile Safari inside those apps. I think even like the new Google Chrome app is mobile Safari, if I'm not wrong. And that Yahoo one is mobile Safari because of the way Apple locks things down. But it's just got different Chrome on it and different utilities in some way. I believe, but I could be totally lying to you.
Follow
I think, well, I mean, like, for example, there's the Opera app for the iPhone, and that definitely uses a different rendering engine. So I would imagine that the Chrome one uses their own version of WebKit underneath.
But is that Opera Mini, or is it?
Opera for the iPhone is.
Okay.
Things look different.
So you're advising,
because they don't have a rendering engine, right? They just send you them. But what if you're on an Android phone and there's an app on it that will open a WebKit view too? Or if you're using on a phone that has built-in Opera, but they allow apps on that platform, it'll probably use some. You know, I don't know. If you're a little app, if you write a fart app and it happens to have a web browser in it, you definitely didn't write that web browser, and you as a developer don't need to test in that fart app just because it has a web browser in it. It is the same rendering engine that comes on whatever phone.
You got it. You got it, Chris.
I hope I'm not embarrassing myself.
I have a theory. You keep on talking about this, your roof of your mouth. Are you sure you didn't get like a tongue ring and you just like won't admit to it? That like that's the problem?
I have sleptwalk before. You should see it. It's freaking gross. Do I literally sound weird? I bet I do.
No, you sound good.
You're
it's
fine.
It's the size of like a lima bean. I need to go
it's a tooth. I'm telling
it
you.
It is. It has to be.
I hope it's.
You're shape shifting.
I watch enough. Maybe I'll like. You know, Prometheus style. It's going to like. Let's do one more, guys.
Yeah.
Company.
I think we got an audio question here. Does that sound good? From Chris LeBron.
Ball of wax, guys.
What's that?
Go for it.
Okay.
Hey, guys. First off, just want to let you know how much I love the show. It's quickly become one of my favorite web dev podcasts, so... Yeah, it's like a weekly high five for my ears. I have a couple questions for you guys about accessibility. I personally have a short list of steps that I go through on each of my projects, regardless of the client's needs. Stuff like aiming for semantic markup, adding focus states, skip links, alt tags, etc. Mainly, common sense stuff. I'm wondering if there's more I could or should be doing on each of my sites. I'm somewhat familiar with YARIA and often use the landmark roles, but I'm not sure how much those actually help at this point in time. So my main question is, what steps do you guys personally take on each of your projects for just like a baseline of accessibility? Your general best practices, as it were. The other thing I was wondering is if you know of any good resources for accessibility. I read 456 Barrier Street, which is great. And I've also tried the official WCAG site, but ironically, I find it seriously inaccessible since it's bursting at the seams with content and it looks like 1997. Do you guys have resources that you turn to regularly for accessibility issues, tips, tricks, etc.? Thanks, and keep up the good work.
Whoa, that one is a hammer. All right, who wants to go first?
Not it.
Okay. Well, I'm not the best person to ask about this, but I try to like tab around with my keyboard just because I like use the keyboard a lot. So that's just kind of an easy way to see how things work. You are interacting with it as opposed to like imagining what somebody else would be dealing with.
Yes, that's a good one.
Yeah. I think so. For me, I think being able to tab around it is smart. If you have anything that opens or closes, being able to like tab around and open that with a space bar is crucial. I'm trying to think of, I mean, at the risk of sounding like an a-hole, I feel like any front end developer should be able to use their screen reader on their system. Like you should know how to do that. You should have one installed. You should fire it up and it's kind of a weird, hard experience, but like you should know how to do that.
I've been using VoiceOver more often on OSX. Just flip it on and see what you get, see what's super annoying and what's not. Yeah, there's resources. I always kind of wanted there to be like a little Tumblr of like little tiny real-worldy tip things are like, oh, this sucked, and I made this change, and now it's better.
Well,
I'm kind of a common sense guy too, though. You know, use semantic HTML. You know, don't hide content that you know people really need to get. Make it pretty obvious if there's hidden kind of functionality. It's not like buried under a hover or something that is hard to get at. Make it reveal on focus too or whatever. Make sure that those functionality items are like next to in the DOM, that you're not like just appending it at the bottom of the HTML element. So when you tab, you'd like don't get that functionality.
And accessibility isn't just screen readers, you know, it's like high contrast mode and other stuff like that. So, I mean, yeah, I'll spill the beans. Here's an insider trade secret. I bought a domain name and I'm going to start a blog that has these kind of tips and tricks that you're talking about, Chris. But if you're interested in, if your like thing is accessibility and you're maybe interested in helping with that, get in touch with me at davidtron5000 on Twitter. But yeah, I want to do something like this.
What about for like the beer camp site with the like page flippy stuff? Did you get a bunch of like troll comments like, yeah, this is cool, but it's not accessible and stuff? Or did you take steps on either of
the two? Yeah, even before that, that site wasn't even – Firefox didn't support it at that time. Or it was like Chrome didn't even – like you couldn't even – it still crashes Chrome. So, you know, accessibility was – it was the first tier of accessibility. Does the page even show up? We were still fighting with that. Yeah, but Dave, to your point, I mean, like I'm colorblind, which is something that people don't consider all the time, and there's weird ways to talk about it. So I think just like talking around sometimes, you hear other people how they use websites, like get more informed about it like that.
Really colorblind. So yeah, I've heard that there's like, you know, some like really higher percentage than you might think of, particularly males for some reason get it worse. And you're one of them, huh? Is it black and whitey, or can you talk about it a little bit?
Yeah. So, it's really, I was just reading an article about color, before the show, but color's fascinating because there's like, it exists in the visual realm, and so to use words to explain, you can't explain the difference between like blue and green, you know.
You just say that one's blue and that one's green, right?
Yes. So like my problem is like I have trouble like distinguishing between like red and green, which is ridiculous because they're two totally different colors, right? Like it's obvious there's red and then there's green, but in certain scenarios, like let's say like text, for example, it's very hard to distinguish between red text and green text, as opposed to like a big red box and a big green box. I'd have an easier time with that. So this is one of these things that'd make a great little post on the Davidtron accessibility blog. So look forward to that.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, and it's ironic too, because a lot of times an error message will be in red. That's a bad error message, and a good error message will be in green. You'd be like, you don't get the bonus. So the words better be sell meaningful. It as much as the color does.
Yeah, or use iconography, or you know, you just use like different kind of border styles. Like maybe like border dotted is better than border solid if it's a warning.
Yeah.
Mix it up.
Mix it up. No, I think that's my problem with accessibility education in general is the 456 Berea Street is really good, but most stuff that you find on accessibility is this, like, it's just an omnibus of like, here's everything ever in plus, you know, 9,000 videos or something, you know, like, and I just want like bite-sized accessibility content. So that's what I'm trying to engineer. So, well, hopefully I'll get around to it. That's kind of the... I'm too busy, but I want to get there. So
this is related, and it does sound a bite-sized.
Well, even just like put it on GitHub or something, so facts could get checked, because there's so much misinformation about accessibility out there that it's frustrating as well. Sorry,
yeah, you gotta get somebody who's off. Like who like needs it, you know, to be your checker.
Yeah, like exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and that's where like doing it in the open would be perfect. So
last one for Dave, because it's kind of related. It was from Jitendra Vyas, who's kind of asking about masonry and jQuery, and like what, you know, I'm sure it works pretty old school. Did you make it work like way back? Is it like IE6 compatible masonry, or where did you cut it off?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Masonry's IE7. Yeah, IE6 and IE7 should be IE7 compatible.
Nice. What's up? So, well, he wasn't even asking that. He's just saying those browsers are slow anyway. What's up is right. But like, so if you, you know, if you're on an old system like that that has, you know, low memory and all that type of stuff, what is it extra? I don't know. He's just trying to ask, is it heavy? Is it weighty? What's the performance like on those old?
Yes. Yes. The animation will look pretty crappy on those ones.
Because, oh, I can even animate? Yeah, I suppose, right?
Yeah, I mean, it will, but it just, you know, look very chunky. So you have to be a smart developer about this. And there's a way you can do conditional comments and detect if you're on an older browser like IE7 and say in your JavaScript, okay, if that checkbox is done, if the HTML class has or if HTML tag has a class of what IE7 or whatever, or old IE, then when your masonry or isotope options or whatever, if you're using like a carousel or something like that, you can say, okay, animated is false. So do not animate in this case. And in the other stuff, you get the nice stuff, right? So you got to be thinking about these things and, you know, that helps the users because the users won't miss the animation. But the, you know, if you're on Safari or whatever on, you know, whatever, Retina screen, MacBook. You should get the good stuff.
I totally ordered one of those. What's up?
Whoa.
I know, but it's my responsibility. But think of how easy that is, guys. If HTML.hasClass, old IE, masonry.animate.false, you know, that's total pseudocode. But it's just a couple of lines of code that you know, that makes a better experience than old.
There's different kinds of like, occasionally I'll get a bug report for like, you know, this is malperformant on a, you know, on my laptop is what it says, but their laptop is like a like, you know, 12-year-old netbook or something like that. Like, how do you, that's a tough area to make, you know, what do you like? To make concessions for. Yeah, to make a call on. But, you know.
I'll tell you what. I just bought an 8. Like, God, thinking of, oh, Chris just buys everything. But I'm having some problems with some old sites and old browsers, just like you're talking about now. And I was like, you know what? I need to have a crappy, underpowered Windows laptop around that with a tiny screen on it. Just so that I have. And it was like $200 brand new, so I can have it. I have like insurance on it. If I drop it or whatever, I'm gonna sit it right next to my crap, and I'm just so that when my Retina one comes, which I'm super excited about, I don't like leave the universe behind. You know, I'm not like, I will never experience a site like most people in the world experience it again. I want to make sure that I have a device that is that related to what you're saying?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Like, you gotta, yeah,
be able to.
I would say masonry takes it about as far as you can take it for animations and everything, right? I don't know. That's a good bar.
I get some emails, and I'm like, you know, usually it's like 20, 80 items you want to be like animating. They're like, well, we're looking to make a site, and it has 10,000 items. Like, would you load 10,000 items onto a page? Like, ah. You
I
know?
Don't type 10,000 letters.
I don't know, but you also, it's not just older machines, you know, it's also mobile now, and there's stuff like, you know, I have a DS and that has a web browser on it. So the web's everywhere, and you got to, you know, we need to have hooks in so we can say, okay, no animation here, or, you know, you don't get the good stuff. So good question. Good. Glad we brought that one up.
So how do you handle support like that? We should probably let you go because it's been forever now. But I kind of like, so, you know, you get emails about masonry. You certainly don't have time to answer every single email you get about somebody wanted to do something weird with all of your many projects. Do you have to just ignore a lot of that? Or?
I mean, you know how it is, Chris. Emails are great and a lot of them are super positive. But, They tend to build up. So I kind of gave a little talk about it. So there's some of my notes are up. So if you go to my GitHub, there's a talk called Open Source Ain't Free. And so I talk about, like, you know, that's why Isotope's a for-profit thing, because charging people money is a way to to attack that problem.
Heck yeah.
And get paid for it, you know? Hey, man.
How do you do that? Tell me. You have to pay to download Isotope now?
You don't, but so it's kind of... It's on the honor system, and there used to be a support option, but I took that off because I couldn't even uphold that. So now it's just... It's just a good way to make sure that the people are using it or the people that are happy using it, I guess.
That's awesome. Oh, okay, well, thanks so much for joining us. You got some wrap-up stuff, Dave? I feel like
David, how can people follow you, give you money, support you, do any of that stuff?
Buy Isotope, I guess.
I'm DeSandro on Twitter, and my site is DeSandro.com.
Awesome. Perfect. Well, cool.
Easy peasy.
Well, I guess that's it. We're going to wrap it up. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Everyone who came out in the chat room, you guys are awesome. Thanks so much. Everyone, be sure to rate us in iTunes and that fancy new podcast app. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show. And special note, some people have commented on audio quality of the show, and totally, we understand. We like good audio too. We're constantly working on it. So thanks for the feedback in that area. But yeah, we're working on it. So that's all I got to say. Chris?
ChopDocShow.com.